I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to On Delmarva. You're about to hear a conversation that we had with Somerset County NAACP President Kirkland Hall. In May of 2009, the Somerset County NAACP and the Maryland American Civil Liberties Union published Semper Eadem, Always the Same, a report that revealed that even though African Americans make up 42% of Somerset County, there's never been an African American elected to a countywide office or appointed or hired for a top county job. Only 3.5% of county employees are black. Only 3 of 21 new hires have been African American. And in the Sheriff's Department, there's only one black deputy. There's a Somerset County Task Force on Diversity made up of folks from every part of the county to address all this. Over the coming weeks, we'll talk with many people in Somerset, from elected officials to residents and leaders from every community. Today we speak with Kirkland Hall, immediate past president of the Somerset County chapter of the NAACP. We caught up with him at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, where he'd been a coach for over 30 years. First, let's check the traffic, and then we'll be right back with Kirkland Hall. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to On Delmarva. Today we speak with Kirkland Hall, immediate past president of the Somerset County chapter of the NAACP.
First, tell me about what's going on now with continuing with the NAACP and the ACLU and the lawsuit. Tell me a bit about that.
When I became president in 1991, the first thing I did was did some research and looking at the leadership component in the county. And we found out that in 1991, we didn't have any African American commissioners. The superintendent of schools was white. Every key position, put it that way, in the county was white. And that concerned me. We have the University of Maryland Eastern Shore across the street, where we groom and teach leaders, and yet no one from this institution ever won or assumed any leadership position in the county, education and or government. Dr. Whitterton was appointed Board of Education superintendent, so they gave us one position, but still others were still vacant. So a couple of years ago, there was a vacancy in the county commissioner office. Sammy Balson, who was the president, assumed the county administrator position. The Democratic Central Committee interviewed four candidates, two African Americans, Ken Ballard and Clarence Bell. The county commissioners had an opportunity to select one of those individuals to serve, to complete the term for Samuel Balson, but they chose not to. So the list went to the governor's office, and he accepted the recommendation, which was a gentleman by the name of James East. So I think that was basically all that we could take. And we talked with Debbie Gian of the ACLU and Amy Cruz, and we did a report called Semper Eadem. And fortunately, it caught the eye of a number of people, even the governor's office. And so we're able to, and the Department of Justice, so we're able to file a lawsuit. We're in the process now of filing that lawsuit.
So it hasn't been resolved yet?
It hasn't been resolved, but we just got information last week by email that the Department of Justice is going to investigate the alleged racial discrimination by the local government.
So talk a bit about what you think is going on among the Board of Commissioners and in the government, and why it was reticent to appoint an African-American to sit on the Board of Commissioners, County Commissioners?
Well, research has shown us that in basically all your municipalities and counties, we have one of the largest African-American population of 41%.
Here in Somerset County?
41%. And that's a significant number. You have five county commissioners. But prior to that, you recall that in 86, we filed a lawsuit. And I wasn't president of NAACP at that time. Matter of fact, I wasn't as active, but I was a part of the community activist group. We lobbied and won a minority district for elections in the county. Before that, it was at large. Everyone ran at large, and of course, we were not successful. Even with that victory, to get a minority in as county commissioner, we still weren't able, still then and still have not been able to elect one. One, the lines are drawn whereas we have the prison, which is located in District 1, and they have over 3,000 inmates who cannot vote. So you have the population, but not the numbers that we needed to elect an African-American commissioner.
You mean that the prisoners in that correctional institute are counted in the population?
Yes.
As people to be concluded when you decide where the vote's going to take place, even though they can't vote?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we, after this past summer, we're in Annapolis again. We are lobbying for the, I can't think of the name, No Population Without Representation Act. Gloria Pugh out of Baltimore. They say Black Caucus came over the law. And the delegation in Annapolis approved our request. In 2012, the prisoner would not be counted in the population in Somerset County. They'll be counted in the area where they're from. If they're from Baltimore, they'll be counted in that population. They're from wherever they're from, that's where they'll be counted. So that will help us tremendously. But with that, that's again, it's 2012, we still think we have a viable chance to get Mr. Craig Mathias elected, only because we feel that the climate has changed. Based on some conversations we've had with different civic groups, more people now are in favor of a change in the way the county commissioners see it with five whites in the office.
And you think the majority of those county commissioners now support this?
No. No. They didn't support the No Population Without Representation Act, and they did not. They were in denial with the research that we've done with the data. They didn't believe that was true. They said they've been hiring African-Americans throughout the years, and we can't find them, whoever they were. They said that African-Americans, had a diverse, committee to interview candidates. But we found out that wasn't true. So everything that we've asked them that they said was true, basic research shows that it was not. And so this is why we're putting pressure on them, hoping that they'll concede and understand that it's time for a change.
What year is this?
2010.
So are there any county commissioners who support the effort of the five, of those five members?
I don't know anyone who have come forward and stated vocally or even the press that they are in favor of a change in the looks of the county commissioners as they stand now.
What about the elections that are taking place right now in 2010? Are there African-American candidates in Somerset County?
Well, I think there's a dramatic change even as we speak today. We will now have three African-Americans on the Board of Education.
Is that an elected position?
Well, it's elected, yes, mm-hmm. But nonpartisan. So we have three. We have three presently on the Democratic Central Committee. Mr. Ken Ballard, I was appointed, elected on Tuesday, along with Margo Gale. But Margo Gale, we have to resign from the Democratic Central Committee because she's going to be appointed to the Board of Education. So they'll give us three African Americans on the Board of Education and two on the Democratic Central Committee.
Out of how many of each?
Five. And six on the Central Committee. And now with Craig Mathias as a candidate for District 1, prayerfully he'll win this election.
And what's he running for?
A county commissioner, District 1.
And so tell me about District 1. Is District 1 where most of the African Americans live in Somerset County?
Allegedly, because the prison is counted in that district.
How would you have it done other than the way it's being done? Well, how would you create an African-American district?
Well, just like we proposed in Annapolis, that even though the prisons are in that district, let them be counted in their former residence. And with that, you can get a different picture of who needs to be counted in District 1 so the lines can be drawn. The university is a part of District 1, portion of the university.
And students legally could vote here if they wanted to.
If they're registered. But most students, the largest are at home.
So where do the majority of African Americans live? Are they just scattered across the county? Are they concentrated in particular areas that could make up a district?
Well, there are some pockets. Presque Isle, which is a little municipality we have here, is minority African American now. But again, you have part of District 3, District 2, and District 1 getting a piece of the town of Presque Isle. the campus with 4,300 students is divided down the middle. There was a road which is no longer in existence called Backbone Road, which divided the campus. One part District 1, one part District 2. Of course, the prisoners with 3,000 have committed called Hampton Avenue, which is about 200 or 300. Greenwood, that may be about 200. But again, those people in those areas, which are called transit residents, you know, they come in and rent for a while, then they leave and go elsewhere. So really, you just can't get a hold because they're the homeowners. And in the city of Crisfield has a large population of African Americans.
Is Crisfield, wasn't there an African American mayor of Crisfield, or was there an African American sheriff of Crisfield? What was it?
Clarence Bell was African American chief of police for two different terms.
And he was elected?
Appointed. By the town council.
And what about the African American representation on the town council and the mayor's office in Crisfield?
Well, I think Crisfield, all honesty, is, in the past year, have leaps and bounds ahead of the county. Although they've never had an African-American mayor, but they had a large two African-American representatives on the city council, and which I think significant improvement.
So, I'm curious about you grew up here.
Yes.
So then, except for the time that you went off to graduate school, this is where you've lived. This is your home.
Graduate school 1 year in Ohio and Fayetteville, North Carolina for 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm. And so, talk to me about why you think that Somerset County, with the third largest African-American population in the state of Maryland, mm-hmm. is battling for representation. Talk about what the kind of the history and soul and of this place that makes it this way. What do you think is going on?
I think it's a twofold problem. One, racism is rampant. There's still allegations of Ku Klux Klan in the community. There are pocket meetings between people in authority and people in the community who are business owners who are working under the table to keep African Americans out of positions. But I think another problem is just education. With this university here, we have people who just live across the river tracks have never been on this campus. And I believe, in my 30 years here, that a number of people in the community, matter they even resent the campus being here.
You're talking about white people?
White and black. I think white and black resent the campus being here. And education is something that's not pushed in the public schools. It's not pushed in the community. I don't hear many pastors pushing education. So it's a serious issue. And we had a meeting on Monday night. We had a forum in August. We advertised it the best we could in all the newspapers, on radio, on television. And then we were told that some people didn't know about it. It was a newspaper two times.
What was it about, this forum?
We had all the people run for office who run for office give a chance to express their views and what their dreams are and their visions. We have a newspaper called Crisfield Times. It was in there twice. Somerset Herald, which is our local president newspaper, in there twice. In the Daily Times, on television, and on radio. But yet, still, there were people who said they didn't know that the forum was going to be held. The Crisfield Times only come up once a week. The Somerset Herald comes up once a week, one Monday and one Wednesday. The Somerset Herald is free, which gives all the local information about what's going on. And they still have a time. You go to the state, any store, you see stacks of paper still left. Because people won't read it. And we're trying to understand. Even at the meeting that I attended, there were some people say, I don't read the newspaper. But yet they claim to be community leaders. And do not read the newspaper. Do not watch the news. I'm concerned. So that's what I'm saying. It's about education. And not only it's about people educating themselves to understand issues. I'm resenting. Because I take on some issues that they think this can cause some backlash. But again, I'm blessed. I'm tenured here, and I try to do the best I can on my job. But people just—it's a fear factor.
A fear of what? When you said backlash, what do you think people what are people afraid of?
Well, there are not many jobs in the community.
Are not many jobs.
There are not many jobs. Unemployment, I think, is well over 15-16% of the whole county, but about 30-35% African American community. because there were many businesses, Paul's Kitchen, Carver Hall, Camel Soup, all those places have closed down. So once you get out of high school now, at one time you had a place to go in the manufacturing job, but now they're not there anymore. So if people don't get education, don't graduate from high school, or don't go to college, it's tough to even get a job and get out of college. But there are no jobs in this community. So people afraid, who have jobs will not speak up against the establishment.
So the lawsuit again, I'm curious about some of the stories about the struggle to make that change. I mean, have there been any, do you find any allies politically, socially, in the white community for what you are struggling for in this county?
Senator Stolfus, who just retired.
The Republican state senator.
He didn't make a statement as he resigned or submitted his resignation that he has witnessed firsthand how African-Americans have been treated, how minority populations have been treated in Somerset County. And he feels that the No Population Without Representation Act should be approved by the Delegate Assembly because he feels it's time for a change. And he said, some people may take it because I'm stepping down, but as I look and I review and I contemplate that it's time for a change. And he's the only one who has come forward. There's not been another community leader in this county that came forward, said they're in support of this report that we presented over a year ago.
The candidates for state's attorney, none of those?
No. Only those involved in the on the task force and NAACP are the only ones who make statements. And one other young man by the name of Reverend Albert Bell. Other than that, no one has made a statement. But no leaders in the white community, except for Senator Stolfus, have made a public statement.
So you grew up here. This is your home. Yeah. And your family's from here?
This is my home. Family's from here.
For as long as your family can remember, this is where you have lived.
That's right. Since 1850.
Since 1850. That's how you can trace your family back to 1850.
My great-great-grandfather back. Ismael Green, Ismael James, and the wife, India Dorm, who's an American Indian.
And so was he a free man? He's a slave.
That's what we are not sure. We know that he came from North Carolina. And his name was Ismael Green. But when he got to Maryland, he changed to Ismael James. So that tells us that he was probably a slave and changed the name to James, hoping that he would not be put back in slavery.
So then this, you know, people talk about what the civil rights struggle was like in Mississippi and mm-hmm. Alabama and to the deep south, Louisiana, Arkansas. But in many ways, where we're sitting now in Somerset County in Delmarva is also the deep south.
Considered, yes.
But it seems in some ways that the, and I don't want to make a value judgment here, I'm just asking a question. It seems in some ways that when it comes to the election of African-Americans or African-American participation in community life, that more advances have been made in Mississippi than have been made in Somerset County.
Okay, let me look at that. Geographically, north we had a Chesapeake Bay Bridge. South, the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. We're basically isolated. We have a number of people who have never been across the bridge. Some people haven't been out of their own hometowns. So therefore, black and white. So what you see, it is all you know. And what we have been doing in the communities, furnishing trips for kids to go to Baltimore, to go to Washington, D.C., to go to New York, to go to Pennsylvania or Philadelphia, so they can see another part of the world. And a lot of our kids, a lot of our adults have just been isolated from the real world, and this is the way it has been, is the way they see it, and the way they believe it should be.
So what is it about... What do you think it will take to change the from your perspective, the kind of attitudes and perspectives in this county, both black and white?
In 1969, I graduated from high school, all-black high school. That was the last integrated school in the county.
Segregated, you mean?
Segregated school in the county. Brown versus Board of Education was passed in 1954. Yet, 1969 was when Somerset County decided to integrate schools. They closed the black schools, of course, and all the white schools remained high school with the same name. They didn't change Washington High to Preston School of Preston Zan or some other name. It's still Washington High. Today, they have class reunions. From whenever Washington High was founded to 1969, that group meets. No one else is invited. Then from 69 on, those classes have their reunion. Not only that, with that picture, I even argue about that. I said, why didn't you change the name if you didn't want the students who go to Washington High now to be a part of your class reunion? The statement was, well, I don't think they can relate to our kind of music. I went to some, we're dancing the same kind of music. We didn't have black radio stations when I was coming up. We listened to all the white stations. So all the music, all the groups they talk about, I know about. And we danced to that same music. So that wasn't a viable argument. But again, I've got dissension and people saying that I'm picky and I'm looking for trouble. But I said, no. I'm just trying to bring the community together. Anything we do to divide the community, I think it hurts us more and more. And it's a sad documentary, but it's just the way it is.
I can't believe what you just said, but somebody said to you that you wouldn't appreciate our music, which is why we have to keep the reunion segregated.
I've got the articles. I have the articles.
Do you have friendships across racial lines in this county?
Well, my best friend, he's from Wacombe County. He and I played baseball together here, roomed together at Ohio State, and still friends. And I have a number of friends, but I think it's a fear. Because of that, those wounds, that racial strife, that's so embedded in our community, they're coming to me for help for election time. But after that, if we don't, go to the same places, we don't go to dinner together, we don't go to church together, and I go to integrated church, one of the few. As a matter of fact, I just adopted two Hispanic girls.
You did?
Yeah. 1-6 and 1-4. Sisters, and I have a son that's biracial, adopted. My kids are grown, so I'm a foster care parent, and I chair the review board for foster children for Somerset and Worcester County. So children are children as far as I'm concerned. But when you get past that, the same bigotry, the same racial stripes, same prejudice come back to the forefront.
Who comes to you for help? The local politicians?
Many. I'm getting ready to meet with some in a few weeks. They want to develop some strategies and how they can win the next election. The state's attorney, Chris Hickman, she invited me to her house last night, but I was unable to make it because we had a Democratic Center meeting. There are others who have been invited me to talk.
Well, when you meet with Mr. Hickman, who's running to keep her seat, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
For the state's attorney in this county, Somerset County. Mm-hmm. And she comes to seek your help.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to her about the help you need to ensure African American voices and seats in local political office? Have you said that to her?
I have not met with her as of yet, but we have an agenda that we're going to put before her even before we inform her whether or not we're going to support her or not. I believe, and again, Turner called me yesterday and explain that Somerset County has the highest sentence rate, they give more years to first-degree offenders than any other county in the state of Maryland. And I told her I'd like to read that before I present that to her. For instance, drug offenders, somebody caught with marijuana, or somebody caught with crack cocaine, I think the minimum sentence they get is 6 or 7 years in Somerset County. I can't document that because I explained how I want to meet with her. I want to see that in writing. And this is from a defense lawyer.
Are these black defendants or black and white defendants?
I don't know, but we'll see what happens. Now, statistically, we have very few young whites in the county that are caught selling drugs.
Well, that's why people don't do drugs.
Yeah, they don't do drugs. Yeah, so that's the problem. So the numbers high. You go in court, all you see, young black males. The police chief of President Zan's, they got a grant from the state of Maryland, alcohol and tobacco prevention grant. He said and I quote, I might miss a word or two, said, it's going to be difficult for us to get grants in the future because crime is so low. It's low because they're arrested. Almost every young black male or on probation in a county, that's not working. And it's an issue, it's a problem. So we're going to meet with him next week and have him give some data.
And this is the police chief of the town of Prince
Susanne? Prince Susanne, yes.
Which is in this county?
Yeah, in this county, yes. It's interesting. I mean, this is
when you first came on the show with Deborah Gian and whoever.
Yeah, Deborah Gian, right.
I was just flabbergasted that this was still.
Yeah.
This is still going on.
Yeah. It's interesting.
That was Kirkland Hall, immediate past president of the Somerset County NAACP. And next, we'll bring you the first in our recurring series of voices from Delmarva. We sat with Salisbury University professor of philosophy, Jim Hartley, in his backyard, which was filled with plants he'd gathered from across the peninsula. Some by gathering them from the side of the road, others from the middle of a swamp. He grew up on the plains of Montana and talked to us about how starting a garden here on the Eastern Shore helped him put down his own roots. So, I mean, in the way we were introduced was that environmental philosophy is the key to your work.
That's true.
What does that mean?
To a point.
Yeah, to a point, okay.
To a point. And I would actually say it's not environmental that's the environment that's the key to my work. It's creation that's the key to my work. So I have a strong religious sense of the world. And creation and the sort of transcendence at work at it forces way beyond any sense of the human, the depth of time. It's a temporal landscape out there. You have this sense of times that go way before the human, particularly once you know the geology of the place. And at a certain point I realized, okay, there are lots of people dealing with issues about human justice, and I could be another one, and indeed I am, but what about justice for the entire planet? And if there's anywhere where there's something really horrific going on that's not being registered, that's not being attended to, it seemed to me it was the loss of habitat, the loss of species, the extinction event, as we're now calling it, the emergence of the Anthropocene, which has bothered me all along. You know, it's like one of these underlying themes.
Mm-hmm. But I'd like to hear about the effect this place has had on you. How many years have you been here? 20?
20 years.
20 years.
Over the years, a lot of cool things have happened here that have helped me to make sense of this place.
Like what?
Well, okay, like a Roshi came here, and I had him lecture to a class on a Japanese garden that was at the Honors House. And what happened was interesting. He looked at the garden for a while, and he said, well, yes, that's a very good Japanese garden, but is it an Eastern Shore garden? Is it a garden that actually pays attention to the world that's here? And then he began to relate how whenever he is in a new place, he waits for a few years before he builds his garden, which is very much a meditative practice. And I thought, you know, that's what I've got to do. I've got to do that. That's the way I'll begin to make peace with being here, is I'll begin to grow things here. And that led to, you know, 10 years of intense gardening and growth as an environmental philosopher, because you really need to know, you know, the world you're defending. You can't just defend it as a policy project. It has to be a lived relationship. I guess another way that this area has really deeply affected me is it's given me a really profound respect for rural identity and rural ways of life and rhythms. And the possibilities for doing really profound philosophical work in such a place. It really gives you space to think.
So, when you, in your work as an environmental philosopher here at the university, one of the big issues that faces the shore, as we were joking about with people, is the big chicken. We can't get away from the power of the chicken on the shore.
800-pound chicken.
The power of chicken.
In the coop, right.
How do you approach that when you, in your work, and you're thinking about people and the land?
That's a good one. Part of what the environmental studies program is about is renewing a relationship with the land that is not simply a technological process. And let's not just pick on chickens. Just about everything in our culture is so driven by mass production and technology that it's had a lot of, you know, positive outcomes, one might argue, lower prices for food, etc., but a lot of negative outcomes too. So for me, the real issue is not, you know, I'm not a political thinker as much as some. I'm not worried about that. I'm not even maybe a social thinker. I mean, I obviously care about things like the plight of migrant workers, etc. But when I teach as a philosopher, the thing I want to do is get people aware of how they can renew their relationship with the living world in all the various ways that can happen. And then let that infect the political and social processes in whatever way it can. I'm very Thoreauvian in a sense in my politics. So I try to not so much fight the 800-pound chicken as to draw attention to its being in the room, and then offer my students some seeds and a plot of ground and say, wouldn't it be nice to have a deeper relationship with your food, to not just think of it as something you go to the store and buy, like you buy a box of bobby pins, you know, that it's something that comes from somewhere. To begin to think, we have this term phenomenology in philosophy, which means to sort of understand the meaning of something as it presents itself in its meaning. And food is, you know, the phenomenology of food will tell you we've sort of lost track of the reality of it, of the beauty of it, of the goodness of it. And if we restore that, then it's more likely that people will be very attentive to the political and social and ethical issues surrounding things like mass production farming.
Tell us about your garden. Tell us where we're standing and what's happening in your garden.
Yeah, okay. We're standing sort of near the swampy area. One of the things I discovered as I took the Buddhist Roshi's advice and began to let the landscape instruct me as to how to make a garden here is that this is an area of swamps. Swamps and marshes. I didn't even know the difference between swamps and marshes before I came here. Swamps got trees, a marsh doesn't. And I decided that, you know, since this place is watery, why not make some things with water in it? And so this area right here is actually an old pond that had a little crack in it. And so I just filled it up with dirt, put clay where the crack was so it would seep more slowly, and then gathered a few plants from various places. That willow tree that's almost 10 feet tall was a little tiny branch, a little stem that of some little plant. I thought it was going to be a little plant that I just pulled out of a bog somewhere, and began putting things in there. And then this one over here, you see the beautiful the goldenrod there. It's just full of insects. I just pulled that out of a ditch down in Somerset County, and it's just growing like crazy. That's another boggy area. And one of the things I discovered was that I didn't have to work hard at all to grow these things. And a student of mine actually caretook my garden one year. And she said, you know, this is like Tai Chi, or this is like Taoism, this is like Wu Wei, this is effortless gardening. You've actually put things in here that you have to attend to a little, but the landscape wants to grow them so much that really you just have to keep them from overflowing. And that's more or less what happened with this series of gardens. I was very, very happy that she sort of made me realize it was a Wu Wei form of gardening, or what she calls gardening with ease. I was just looking at the goldenrods. They're just full of insects, as are these butterfly bushes here. One of the things that's really cool about planting indigenous plants, plants that are from the area you're from, I guess when it comes to Delmarva, I'm definitely got myself socked into the plant life. I'm getting to know it well. They attract all sorts of species of insects that, like regular garden plants, won't. So they're an amazing array of crazy little quirky critters just feasting down on those humble little goldenrod plants, which once you get to see all those insects on it, you begin to see those goldenrods as almost princely or kingly. There's something quite dignified about them.
That was Jim Hatley, professor of philosophy at Salisbury University.
You're listening to On Delmarva with your host, Mark Steiner, on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away, because right after this break, we'll be back with Congressman Frank Craddaville. I'm Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with Congressman Frank Craddaville, who is seeking re-election in the 1st Congressional District in the Maryland portion of Delmarva. And Frank Craddaville, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm curious about some of the things that were just recently in the paper. The Environmental Protection Agency is proposing a really tough and stringent new federal mandate that would not just affect Maryland, but would affect all of the states that are in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, that are part of the polluting of the Chesapeake Bay and the lack of its growth and coming back. And I wonder what your take on that is.
Well, listen, I think it's clear that over the years we've talked about protecting the Bay in various ways. We've talked about it and talked about it, and ultimately we haven't made much progress. So I think on one hand we clearly have to do something else other than what we're doing. Having said that, I also think we need to recognize that protecting the Bay, on one hand, is not mutually exclusive from protecting, let's say, the agricultural industry. I think we've got to recognize a lot of steps that ag has done, particularly in Maryland, and recognize the impact that steps we take are going to have on ag. So ultimately, I think there's a balance between moving forward and protecting the Bay and at the same time making sure we're not killing our agricultural industry. Both of those industries are critically important to our economy and also clearly our way of life on the Eastern Shore, the district, and really the state. So the bottom line is I think we need to do more. I think some of the efforts to provide some incentives for states or, saying, look, states, you said you're going to meet these goals over the last number of years. You haven't met them. If you don't, there's going to be some consequences for that.
When we talk about protecting agriculture, clearly agriculture is a hugely important industry on the Eastern Shore and all of Delmarva in terms of providing jobs and that go way beyond the farm. But it's been agriculture that has been pointed to, especially certain kinds of farming, large-scale chicken farms and others, that have been pointed to as one of the major
right.
sources of pollution. And that on a voluntary basis, some people have argued, that it's not doing the job to clean up the Bay, that we have to have something's got to be done beyond what's happening now.
Well, listen, I think you're certainly correct that we still have issues from our farms that are causing problems in the Bay. But again, in terms of moving forward, I think we do need to recognize what agriculture has done, number one. Two, recognize that whatever we do, look at the impact that that's going to have on the ability to operate a farming operation. But also look at the other areas that are causing problems with the Bay, whether it's wastewater treatment issues, whether it's development, whether it's issues from, nearby states. I think we need to look at those as well. But you are correct that, despite the fact that we've done a lot in the ag industry, and I think if you look at percentage of pollution, ag is actually going down when compared to some of those other areas. But despite that, we clearly need to do more. And as I said, I think so long as the rules and regulations that ultimately come about are fair, and the states, let's say a EPA along with Department of Agriculture, come up with a plan that says, farms are going to do this, and everybody agrees to that. The state says that that's a reasonable effort. And so long as that happens, and the state doesn't meet those requirements, then I think it's not unreasonable to have some consequences for that. Not in terms of the individual farms, obviously, but in terms of the state.
What does that mean? Would it mean not the individual farms, but the state?
Tying funding. I mean, discussions of tying funding to failure to meet those, not meeting the reduction levels.
So how do you think we get there, though? I mean, clearly when the University of Maryland study just came out and the rivers on the Western Shore actually got better grades than the rivers on the Eastern Shore in terms of pollution, and the state of the rivers, the chop tank got a D. And clearly something is wrong. I mean, that that the place that is that everybody loves and adores, this Delmarva Peninsula, is still in environmental trouble.
It is, and again, my point on that is that's true. But in terms of efforts that have been taken, I think ag have the agriculture industry has done a lot. Their percentage is dropping, while other areas are increasing. But listen, we're not disagreeing.
I'm just asking.
I think we do need to do more in terms of the agriculture industry. I have fought for funding to do that. But I think we've got to be very careful about having absolute mandates that aren't reasonable, that don't take into consideration the impact on that industry when we're making regulations. And what I've tried to do is to find that balance between, on one hand, recognizing clearly we have to do more, not just in the agricultural industry, but listen, one of the things I'm looking at is we provide all these federal dollars that go to upgrade wastewater treatment plants. And ultimately, you know, the question is, down the line, are those plants used to increase development that ultimately put us in a worse position than we were in to begin with? So we have to look at all of these areas. We have to be reasonable about it. But I do agree that ultimately what we have been doing is not working, and there has to be consequences for the states to not meet these goals.
So when you look at things like, without getting into the specifics of it, the lawsuit that some waterkeepers and others brought against Purdue and the Hudson family, one of the key elements of that, and the argument still we'll talk about, we can talk about, which is whether it hurts or helps family farmers and that are emblematic of the Hudsons.
Right.
But whether or not Purdue as a company, or Tyson, or any of those companies that contract with these farmers, have as much responsibility as the farmers in responding to whatever runoff takes place.
Let me say this. I don't think the solution to our problems in moving forward are civil suits. And now, in terms of the particulars of that, I don't think it's appropriate for me as a congressman to discuss the particular merits of the legislation. I will say that in terms of finding that reasonable balance between promoting ag and protecting the bay, I don't think civil litigation is the best approach. I do think the best approach is moving forward with ways of making sure that the states are coming up with a plan to meet these goals and then carrying it out.
I wonder, as a leader, as someone who wants to go back to another term in Congress and represent the people of the Eastern Shore and the rest of your district, what does that leadership mean in that regard? I mean, how do you leverage that leadership in Congress to address that issue? I mean, it's
very easy. The answer to that is I serve on both the Ag Committee and the Natural Resources Committee. From that standpoint, I get to hear both sides of these issues. And the way you do it is you, in terms of the laws that are passed, you make sure that there is a fairness in terms of those regulations, that everybody knows what the rules are, that they're, again, if a state is coming up with a plan to meet those pollution reduction goals, that they set forth a plan to do it, and that they carry it out. And as I said, if they don't, then assuming everybody knows what the rules are, assuming everybody has participated in openly in the creation of those rules, if the states don't meet those limits, then I think it's appropriate to have some consequence.
And what kind of consequence would that be?
Well, it could be funding. You know, we've done that in other areas where if you take a simple example, what we did with drunk driving, I mean, the federal government obviously does have the ability to withhold funding if, in fact, states aren't meeting their goals. But I think my point is that the focus of where you're leading with your questioning is directly related to ag only. And I disagree with that. Ag is part of the problem, but it's not the only part.
Oh, no, clearly. No,
you know,
no,
I live here on Thompson Creek or Cox Creek, and you have people that are, you know, putting fertilizer on their lawn that's running into the creek. Everybody has a part to play in this. Ag has done quite a bit, I think, and we need to recognize that. Everybody has a part to play, and we ought to make sure that those plans that we come up with make sure that everybody's playing a part, sets the rules so everybody knows what they are, and then we make sure that they're carrying them out.
No, I agree. I mean, I think there are a lot of players here, but the question I guess some people would ask on either side is, then how tough does regulation have to be or not be when it comes to that? I mean, whether it's the runoff from increasingly building roads because of development, or the runoff, as you just talked about, in Thompson Cox Creeks from all the fertilizer and stuff we put on lawns, the chemicals, to all that, to the sewage treatment plants, waste treatment plants, wastewater treatment plants, that all those go to contributing to pollution of the rivers and pollution, period. How do you get to the point, though? I guess some people are trying to ask whether whichever side they're on is, how do you get to the point? What visionary leadership is there to talk about how we're going to get to the place where the environment is restored and people can live a decent life?
Right. And again, I think the answer to that is, in terms of moving forward, we do have to recognize that we can do whatever we want in Maryland, but if Pennsylvania and New York aren't doing their fair share, then we're not going to make a lot of progress. So from that standpoint, clearly there is a federal role. And what we're talking about doing, what's being discussed, is requiring the states to set these goals, come up with a plan for meeting them that would be approved. My view is that they should be approved both by EPA and Department of Ag. And once those plans are set, each of those sectors have to comply by those rules and make those goals. And if they don't, then there's a hammer over their head.
When you look at Governor Martin O'Malley's plan to replenish oysters, that's also caused a lot of controversy. The watermen saying, look, you don't understand. We know how to do this better than what you're describing. The scientists saying, no, that the deep dredging is a mistake. You need to have the areas that have the most oysters, or the best oyster breeding areas, need to be set aside so they can replenish, and then we go back to harvest them. And, of course, many of the watermen are saying, no, that's not the way to do it. We need to at least do part of it to unearth the oysters so they can replenish themselves. So this is a huge battle going on, and Martin O'Malley has his plan. That'll be part of this gubernatorial election. And I wonder what your thoughts are on his plan and the controversy around the future of oysters.
I think a lot of those issues are similar to what we're talking about, the same balance between ag and the environmental interest, I would say, is the same as it relates to the watermen and protecting the environment. And my overall thought on that is there's a balance. I do think, you know, we certainly can't allow the situation to get so bad that in 10 years there aren't any watermen. So I think steps that are taken, that on one hand, acknowledge that there's a problem, acknowledge we need to take steps to improve the problem, but at the same time are not so dramatic that they put whether it's the ag industry or whether it's, you know, watermen out of business completely. And there's a balance in that. I know there has been dispute on these particular areas, you know, as to which areas are more productive than the others. Certainly the watermen are saying that the areas that are being cut off are much more productive, and that the percentage that has really been taken from them is substantially greater than is alleged. Ultimately, my view is, again, there has to be a balance in that. We do need to take steps to make sure that we are making positive improvement in terms of the oysters, and there's got to be some mechanism to do that. That has to be balanced with a recognition that we don't want to do something so dramatic that we have no watermen.
If you were to outline the most critical issues facing the shore, what would they be?
I would say, number one, you know, we just got some stimulus dollars for broadband. It's going to help us get broadband out to the Eastern Shore. I think that will do a lot to help us in terms of promoting tech jobs, hopefully be able to grow our economy on the shore. I think that's a big issue. I think two of the issues that you've raised, I think, are the two of the most critical and the most difficult, which is finding that balance between recognizing that on one hand, we in terms of economically, we need to protect the ag industry. We have a huge poultry industry in the First District. We can't afford to lose that, but at the same time, recognizing that we can't continue to allow the bay to be degraded. So that is the single biggest challenge in our district. And I think what we need are people that are going to be reasonable and fair in drafting the changes affecting those industries. The other issue you mentioned, again, the balance with the watermen is the same. But I don't think those interests, as I mentioned before, goals are mutually exclusive. I think we can do both. I think that the key to that is making sure that up front, everybody knows what the rules are, everybody's had an opportunity to be heard, everybody's participated in the process, and that the result of that is a fair changes to the law, and then making sure we meet whatever those goals are.
Frank Redville, thanks so much for taking your time with us.
Thank you, sir.
It's been a pleasure, and we'll talk to you down the campaign trail and beyond.
Sounds good.
All right.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Mark Steiner. We've just had a conversation with Frank Redville, First District Congressman, seeking re-election here on the Demarville Peninsula. Coming up now, noted author and Eastern Shore native Tom Horton digs deep into one of Delmarva's defining features, drainage ditches.
Hello, I'm Tom Horton for On Delmarva, reporting from one of the Delmarva Peninsula's most iconic landscapes. I'm not talking about glorious ocean beaches or vast sweeps of marsh, not picturesque harbors, rippling fields of grain, or winding tidal rivers either. Nope, today we're talking ditches. I'm paddling down one now, a most magnificent drainage way, 80 feet wide, big enough to float a couple cabin cruisers side by side, flowing turgidly toward the Chesapeake, some 60 miles distant, right through the heart of Delmarva. I plopped my canoe in the ditch half a mile back where Route 404 to the beach crosses it near Woodenhawk in Sussex County. It stretches miles, brown and shallow, arrow straight, and pretty boring. Treeless banks sculpted to 45-degree slopes that rise several feet above a paddler's head. The ditch is not here for scenery. It's here to whisk the rain off more than 100,000 acres of mid-Delmarva cropland, a job it performs with admirable efficiency. For literally thousands of miles across Delaware and Maryland's eastern shore, drainage ditches big and little have replaced, altered, and bypassed natural streams and wetlands. This vast network of ditches enables a valuable agricultural bounty, also degrades a lot of natural waterways, and provides a conduit for polluted runoff to the Chesapeake. We take it for granted that a straight line is the shortest way between points, but sometimes forget to ask whether it is always the best way. A river knows. Paddle on with me a bit to where ditch maintenance ceases and the universal tendency of free-flowing water to bend and loop, to curve and wander, begins to reassert itself. Roots and stumps and shrubs roughen the unbush-hogged banks, now catching sediments in which little wetlands take root. The ditch's flow is forced around these obstacles, bending to and fro, carving channels, twinkling in the sunlight where it burbles over fallen logs. Overhanging river birches appear, offering pockets of shade dimpled by minnows stalked by a great blue heron. A fresh beaver chew blazes on a swamp maple. A big woodpecker, pileated, flits overhead. Now the forest thickens, braiding the stream through a broad swamp from which shrilling wood ducks erupt. The water flows clean and clear now, rippling through long, undulating blades of ribbon grass and pillow-like masses of calitriki, another water grass whose name is Greek for beautiful hair. Around a bend in a hidden side channel, a banquet table is set. An old stump protruding from midstream, its top richly upholstered in moss, is piled with the delicate shells of freshwater clams, recently opened and devoured by a river otter. The clamshell's cream and gray interiors glisten in the swamp light. Behind me lies the ditch, the straight line, the river in name only, constructed to perform one vital duty, quickly, smoothly, efficiently draining storm water off the flat corn and bean fields across Delmarva. Ahead of me lies the curve, the meander, complexity, diversity, the river serving no one purpose, maximizing not one single thing, rather promoting life in all its beauty and diversity. The river's renaissance includes humans. A rope swing dangles above a deep hole in a bend. A small clearing shows signs of foot traffic along the bank, maybe dip netters seeking spring herring drawn salmon-like from the Atlantic to spawn here by the scent of where they were born. Ditches will likely continue to rule big parts of Delmarva, but where landowners are willing and able to plug them, it's one of the fastest, cheapest ways we know to return land to a more natural state. And by leaving more natural buffers on one or both sides of a ditch, by manipulating water levels in them with floodgates, by paying to take some of the lowest-lying ditched lands out of production, we might just provide better for both drainage and nature. And that's pretty much the straight and the curve of it.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.